I wanted to begin with just a few things that we can kind of agree upon, okay? All appearance is conditioned. All appearance is fabricated. So we went into this before in terms of there's an object and an atmosphere. And this we would actually call a fabrication, okay? Sankara is how it's said, put together. And the sankara is also what we would say, you know, the object is a sankara. Yeah, it's also put together, right? None of these objects actually exist on their own side. You know, say like an object, like a chair, is also made up of wood, you know, and wood itself, so it is put together. And wood itself is also a put together, right? So these sankara, they're all fabricated, made up things, brought together, put together. But the really key thing for us, you know, when we talk about our experience, isn't just that things are put together. Well, that's interesting, but that's kind of science. It's that they're put together and held in an atmosphere, right? And that's really what we're kind of leaning on. So when we talk about all appearance is conditioned, all appearance is fabricated, what kind of conditions, what kind of fabrications are we talking about? We're also talking about our own conditioning, you know, what we've learnt to do. So we might be talking about the habits of our hearts and minds, yeah, where our hearts and minds go. And this might come from our culture, you know, Israeli culture, you know, isn't the same as British culture, you may have noticed, yeah. So our societies are different and they influence us and how we act in certain societies. We may find like, you know, I come into Israel, I act a little bit more different than I do when I'm in Britain, you know, where I feel like, oh yeah, there's kind of like a way to act. And we're people who adapt, you know, we adapt to many environments and we adapt to many societies. There's also like a family vibe that we grow up in, yeah, familiar how we talk among our family group. What's a topic that we're comfortable of going into and what we kind of keep away from. So these have become habits over time. Repeated patterns become habits. They become grooves that we travel along, grooves in our life. And we could say roots we've learned to think and conceive by. Right? And actually, Dharma teachings are suggesting, how about, could we think and conceive a different way? Because when we think and conceive, like conception, give birth to through our thinking. We also perceive, receive the appearance of the world. Okay, so that's some really complex words, which I don't know how well Zara's kept up with. Poorly! Okay, so conceive means give birth to. We give birth through the mind, what we think of. And what we think of is what we experience back. It's this kind of very, very subtle processes. So there's patterns of behaviour we do to fit in, supported by our cultures, let's say in a very broad sense. And then there's a whole other aspect. And don't worry, we don't have to fix any of this stuff. It's just helpful to understand what we're talking about. Yeah. So we're not going to fix our society so that we can have better meditations. And we're not going to reject our societies because, you know, they've been pushing us around for long enough. We exist in a society. Like this Sangha here are a certain type of society where we have certain types of behaviours which are supportive for meditation, and that's delightful. We also have a whole biology going on, yeah? So we talk about Vedana, you know, this five-star review activity. And that was probably seen to be very useful as an evolutionary creature at some point, you know, in the past. It was very useful to very quickly, even before we perceive it, even before we see it, we give it a review, you know. And I've had this idea, it may not be proven by evolutionary biology, but we probably, that Vedana move is this decision between, is this thing my lunch or am I its lunch? You know, and it's those quick decisions we need to make. And the way it's also described sometimes in evolutionary biology that's made up by people like me is that if we don't see that we're someone else's lunch, that's it. You know, the game is over. Right? So it's really important that we notice those things, what's called the negativity bias. It's important to notice what's not okay. And it's important to focus on that. You know, if it's a tiger, you don't want to think, oh yeah, but I'm looking at the flowers. No, it's the tiger and it's got all of our attention. The negativity bias is really important. If it's something nice, more five-star review, it's something tasty, it's okay. That can take our attention, that we get it, we grab it, and we move on. Yeah. So there's these biases also in our biology, and they also fabricate what we see. They also fabricate where our attention is drawn at different times. Yeah, the way we look for treats and the way we look for threats. But the beautiful thing is we're not limited by that. And the more attention we bring to it, we can get to these positions where we have the possibility of entering into equanimity. So equanimity wouldn't be necessarily kind of something that one would see in evolutionary biology. You know, someone who's at peace with all things, equally comfortable with all things. Okay? So we have these habits of behavior and they come through us in difficult ways, usually, yeah? Ways that often hinder, get in the way of, obscure, block, we could say, in really kind of simple words. They block, they stop. Deep well-being, lasting happiness, feelings of nourishment, feelings of well-being, feelings of being well-fed by life. Yeah? So they're called the hindrances in Dharma languages. People who speak about the Dharma use this word hindrances. And some people who look at them in a more light way might say the so-called hindrances. Yeah. So what can we say about these? So the hindrances are often described as greed, or we might say, we'll say greed. I think that's a word we can understand or have a translation for. Ill will, wishing, rejecting, aversion, pushing away, ill will. Restlessness, or we could just say too much energy in the system. Yeah. Another one is dullness, sleepiness, tiredness. You may be feeling that one already. And that's not enough energy in the system. But the beautiful thing is there's things we can do to that. Yeah. If you're feeling dull, if you're feeling tired, your instinct will be to lie down. Right? And that's fine. You can lie down. I don't mind. That's a perfectly reasonable response. But it will actually encourage the dullness, right? If we want to counter dullness in meditation, we should probably stand up. And depending on how much clothes we're wearing, we should probably take some off, you know, or we should get more air, you know, anything that kind of brings us alive, right? I'm just saying that as a helpful advice. I'm not telling you just stand up and start taking your coat off or something. Okay, so there's always something we can do. Yeah, there's the biological, cultural reactivity, what we might be calling Vedana, the five-star review process. Yeah, and then there's like, this is going on. I'm not in that whole process. I'm not in that whole build-up, and I've got choices. I've got ways to respond. And so meditation is the development of possibilities. Okay? So I would say one of the main insights we want to bring to any moment is the possibility that there are other possibilities. Yeah? This is one way of relating. This is just one way I could relate to this. We just remind ourselves, there's the possibility of possibilities. Okay? Because otherwise, we'll probably end up going down this route that the Buddha lay out, many spiritual teachers lay out, called dependent origination. Yeah, the dependent origination of dukkha is what the Buddha was wanting to teach. So let's unpack what that actually means. Let's say there's a chain of events that leads up to our experience of distress, of dis-ease, of unhappiness. I'm trying to go slow and use probably oversimplifying words, but so when you translate them into Hebrew or hold them in your mind, keep thinking, even this is just one way of looking at this. You know, it's probably more dynamic, it's probably more complex, it's probably there's more and more to explore. But let's use each of these as like a doorway in, okay? So there's contact. Something contacts the senses, okay? And the wonderful thing of what the Buddha offered to us is, you know, we have these senses, seeing, smelling, tasting, hearing, touching the world. Yeah, these five senses, five, we might say, physical senses. And then he includes the sense of the intellect, the thinking, the emotions. Yeah, they also contact consciousness, also contact us. So we have all these ways that there's contact. And every time there's contact, there's Vedana, what we're lightly calling the five-star review process. Yeah, the liking, the not liking, the wanting, the not wanting. And so that's a certain degree of reaction. And if we're not really sensitive to the fact that there's reactivity happening every time there's contact, if we're not conscious of that, then we might follow that reactivity and we get what's called escalation, the building up. Okay, so let's say there's an unpleasant feeling in my system. I feel like I don't want that. And that not wanting of that also has a Vedana. Yeah, it's also making contact into consciousness. And so I might only get in touch with this after quite a few layers of reactivity. And the escalation of reactivity also leads to an escalation of thinking. And that escalation of thinking has a really lovely Pali word, which is papancha, which we might say, you know, is like a train of thoughts. Yeah, a train, like linking together, sometimes a really long train. And the thing about trains is, you know, if you're standing on a platform just meditating, you might end up on that train and then whoosh, you're taken away. But at any point in time, the Vedana is available to us because all those layers, they each had a Vedana. And we don't need to think, I need to find out what was the initial contact Vedana. You know, and then I can dissolve all of this dukkha. It's actually the first one you come to. The first one you come to is the one to notice. And there's always something revealing that Vedana for us, which is the body. Yeah? So we can just immediately just pause. Even in the greatest of build-up, the greatest of papanchas, just pause and notice, how is this in the body? Yeah, how is this experience? So it doesn't matter, it could be the most profound, you know, desire. You know, I don't know if you've heard about the hungry ghost realm, where, you know, there's this kind of, unfortunately it's a hell realm that is believed in certain parts of Buddhism that you'll end up in if you don't behave very well, kind of a original sin type of thing. But we can actually feel sometimes in that place in our day-to-day life. You know, we just can't get satisfaction. We want more of this, more of this, more of sensations, more of experiences. There's lots and lots of wanting. Or we might be really at war with life, you know, really fighting against it, really angry, hatred, rejection. Or it could be really subtle. We just feel a little bit off. But we can just pause, acknowledge that this is what's happening. And then we can investigate it. Like how do we feel this in the body? You know, is the body contracted? Is it tight? What's going on? You know, I don't want to be here. Or it's not perfect. This isn't what I want. How is that? How do we know it in the body? And it might be possible that it works for us just in that moment to open, relax the posture a little bit. Even just allowing for any of the tightness to be there. You know, just as we did in Don't Scratch the Itch. Yeah? Not another layer of reactivity at this time. A bit of just loving kindness, metta towards this body, metta towards this experience. And so this really ties in with what Zaha was saying yesterday about the second arrow. The reactivity to the unpleasant is also unpleasant. And so can we just ease that, soothe that, or he lessens the degree. Kindness to what's here. Wherever it is on the spectrum of escalation, eases some of the dukkha, eases some of the dis-ease. And of course, this can be enough. That can be enough. We're actually quite good at accepting, it's a bit better than it was, and that's nice. Yeah, when you've had a high fever and it goes down just a few degrees, it's like, oh, that's so much better. Even though you still have a fever, it's not as high as it was. We feel a bit better. But we can keep on going. We can keep on cooling that fever. We can keep on easing more escalation because we've still got another layer of Vedana to just open to, accept, feel in the body. And you know, it keeps going and going. And if we keep following that thread, experience becomes less and less unpleasant. Yeah. So how are we doing? Are we doing okay? We're following along? Am I? Yeah. Doing okay, all right. So let's just deal a little bit with this kind of famous first hindrance. And I just want to say I'm really, really grateful for all this typing in Hebrew that's going on along here. I'm really appreciative of that. So the interesting thing about greediness, right, is it's rooted from the 5-star reviews or the 4-star reviews or maybe like 3.5 upwards. And if we're really bored, we might actually take a 2.5-star review and develop some greediness from it. Yeah. Initially, the first imprint was this is pleasant, but greediness, right? As we feel it in the body, if you've escalated to greediness and you are willing to stop trying to get that thing, seeing in that object, it's actually a very unpleasant experience to be in, right? And it actually makes sense. So there is the possibility that we could do, as William Blake says, kiss the joy as it flies and live in eternity's sunrise. Kiss the joy as it flies. I think then it says, or hold oneself to a joy is to that winged life destroy. Something like that, a little bit less easy to understand, and I probably haven't remembered it perfectly. But when we clasp onto experience in that way, we crush it, yeah. And it's not that we need to avoid all pleasures, and it's not that we need to have no desires, right? Those kind of more ancient translations, you know, hundreds of years ago, people were translating the hindrance of greediness as desire, wanting something. It's not just wanting something that's problematic. It's actually, I want it for me. I want to attach it onto this self. And that's just not realistic. It's not realistic in terms of the view of exactly what this self is. It's not realistic in where happiness lies. And it's also not realistic in terms of we're usually wanting something that doesn't even last. It doesn't even have lasting abilities to last in any form. And how can it bring lasting satisfaction? You know, we can't own these things. We can't bring these in. And so there is beauty in life. And we can be supported by that beauty. You know, I really love this title of a Mary Oliver poem called Lingering in Happiness. Yeah, lingering in happiness. And when things are going well for us in meditation, I think it's actually a skill we want to learn, a skill that we need to learn, how to remain open and steady in happiness, how to feel good in well-being. And of course, there could be real skillfulness in our desires, as I was starting to say just a moment ago, that desires are not a problem. We have to be really wary of rejecting all desires or all longing for more. Right? The whole spiritual path is dependent on a sense that we are going to be driven towards developing qualities of well-being. In the Pali, often people make a distinction between chanda, the wholesome desire for the spiritual path, and all other desires. But we might actually find that in our lives, we're not monks and nuns, that there's actually space in our life for other wholesome desires. You know, we might want to be wary of spiritual teachings that don't fully fit our lives. We think, oh, I mustn't have a desire. I mustn't have a desire for retreat. I mustn't have a desire for practice. I mustn't have a desire for another human being and a loving relationship or loving connection with people. Or I shouldn't have a desire for political change, you know, in which would be more loving and serving of other beings. Yeah. It doesn't feel like that spiritual ideal would fit into our lives fully. But there is a thing called greediness. There is a thing for, I want this for me. Yeah? And we can counter that. Because something I like to say is that these 5-star reviews, they're not a problem in themselves. Yeah. So if you see something that's got a 5-star review, you might want to buy it for a friend or for someone in need. Yeah. So there's a beautiful thing. It's like you've already done the hard, complex work of figuring out what's good, what's not good, what's worth getting, what's not worth getting. And then we're getting to that point where it's like, and I'm going to get it for me. And then we just switch it at the last minute. Very, very clever switch. And we just pass it on to someone else. Ah, this would be nice. It'd be nice to give that away. And the interesting thing we'll see is that there isn't happiness in things. You know, there's no happiness tied up in the things. And there's a lot more happiness oftentimes in giving the things away. Because if it's well aimed, it will make the other person happy. And we're porous people, and we feel and resonate with that happiness. And that happiness will last longer than the happiness of getting it for oneself, where then we have that whole hassle of having to put it somewhere and make sure that someone doesn't knock it over and break it, or, you know, who knows what it is. But it might have that kind of appearance. So I think what we're saying here is actually that greed is ill will. Yeah, there isn't actually a very big distinction here. It's just somehow in the direction. There's kind of an ill will in wanting to get all the good stuff for me, yeah, and not give all the good stuff to other people. And it's also, you know, probably a deep misunderstanding in what truly brings happiness for us. But there's also the aversion, which is the shutting down in contact to unpleasant experiences. Yeah. And of course, this is a way of relating that also supports dukkha, also brings difficulty. We only want half of life. We only want the good, we don't want the bad. We only want the pleasant, we don't want the unpleasant. And, you know, that doesn't really work, does it? It doesn't really feel that we can have a life like that, but it's quite natural that we could feel to do this. Yeah, I see that. I just finished this sentence, shall I? So, if we have like if we have one of those French breads, like those long baguettes, and we said, I only want the left side and I don't want the right side, you know. And then so we cut it down the middle and we get rid of the right side. And then we're left with this half baguette now. And then very shortly we'll realize that it has a right side still and a left side. And like, how many times are we going to cut it and get rid of the right side? You know, we just keep getting a smaller and smaller piece of bread, which means we've really reduced the range of existence by only wanting the pleasant and not having the unpleasant. Because there's always going to be a range. Right, there's always going to be something that's the least pleasant thing. So it seems that the Dharma teachings, what they're saying is the way that we relate to things which are automatically given these reviews, it's calling us to have a more equanimous feeling, because in that spaciousness, in that openness, it reduces the dukkha. Yeah, and we get the whole baguette, which is like a bonus. And we can share it too. Okay, so let's take a little pause for some questions, some interaction time, and then we'll see where we get back to.
So, Aviv and Rotem, hi.
Hey, I wanted to ask about the desires. I'm not sure if you're going to talk about it again. How does Buddhism define between a good and less good desire? It means that, or maybe intention. As far as I understand and experience up until today from my practice, I feel that a desire that can bring dukkha is a desire when you have like, I don't know, a clear aim that you need to achieve or something like this. But so I'm not sure like about if you can talk about it more.
Okay, sure. So when we kind of want to talk about desires and in what way desires can be in what ways desires can be not problematic, we're touching on kind of sensitive areas of the Dharma, right? And we're needing to clarify for ourselves why we're practicing, okay? So there's a certain way of practicing, which is the development of less and less attachment to things. Yeah, there's this thread of the Dharma, and it's a beautiful thread, and it can be very, very useful. It's particularly suited to like a monastic practice, right? Because, you know, they're also letting go of materiality and relationships, intimate relationships, sexual relationships, and all of these kind of things. And their path can be a letting go of the world. Yeah, really kind of a letting go of the world. And there's something very beautiful and sacred about that atmosphere and attitude, which isn't a rejection of the world, but it's a real clear non-attachment to the world. Okay? And so a lot of the teachings come through with that flavor. But when we examine it and we look, and it's actually, that's not my calling necessarily. Yeah? So we might want to have an approach to our desires, to our deep wishes, that isn't so kind of defined in the terms of renouncing the world, renouncing all of the world, and more a question of renouncing the unwholesome things in the world. And that's why I feel like re-translating the hindrance which we're here calling greed, you know, away from all desires, is making it more appropriate to our lives in that way. So we then, what we've done is simply replace wholesome, yeah, in here. So now you have to decide for yourself what's wholesome. Now the thing is, you know what's wholesome for you, yeah? Like, you know what's a wholesome thing for you. Like, you know, for example, if we binge watch, you know, lots and lots of TV shows, yeah, it's unwholesome. But maybe watching a little bit of that once in a while actually opens something. It gets us more in touch with an empathy for other people and their situation. And I'm just like, wow, there's people who live like this, you know? So there's like a wholesome degree of the things in the desires that we follow, yeah? So it's really intimate, and we have to be in tune with ourselves. And that's why I think, in the same way, it's like when we notice an escalation, feel it in the body. It's like, is this a skillful way to be living? Yeah, is this as we investigate our experience and we're in tune with it, because we're living the Dharma in outside of monastic structures, yeah, where the clear thing is, it's not a fading of the world. It's a way of relating to experience, which is skillful and wholesome. That's how I see it. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you. I think the reason I brought this question is because, as I think we all know, we live in a world where having a desire is even something that, like, counted as something that is good and important, to have a desire to know what you want to do, what you want to achieve. And I think I'm a pretty new practicer, so it's kind of questions that now bothers me a lot. So, yeah, I feel that, like, the answer that you gave is pretty much giving me a direction.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. Thanks for the question. Yeah.
Hi. I will just in a sentence the mood. What about the desire to survive or mm-hmm. to self-preserve yourself?
So we could say it's a desire. You know, we could say it's also like the basic needs. You know, we might even want to make a further kind of distinction there, that it's, you know, we kind of need to survive. You know, we need to eat, we need home, you know, we need all of these things. And yet we can also develop less attachment to those things. And that can be also helpful. Yeah, it can be helpful to accept that, yeah, this being is going to die. Yeah. And everyone I love is going to die. And there's kind of like a wisdom to that. And we also recognize that if I'm not able to tune into that, then I might do things which I would regret because of the urge to survive. Sometimes comes, you know, in unhelpful ways. And that can reveal itself in our politics, you know, at times. Yeah, this kind of fear that I'm not going to survive gets used against us at times.
Okay.
So it's all things we have to be sensitive to and awake with. Yeah. Okay. So maybe if there's another question that feels it needs to happen now, and then we'll just wrap up the last bit of the talk.
Yeah. Okay. So one helpful acronym, like where you put the letters for different things, is RAIN, that we can use for these practices. And the R for RAIN is to recognize, to notice, to pause, to bring mindfulness. Whatever's happening, no biggest degree of escalation or even the subtlest of experiences, just notice. Okay, no blame, no this shouldn't be happening. You know, that's more hindrance, right? So we're just noticing, not rejecting, we're not pulling it towards us. And the A is either allow or accept. We could have that kind of feeling that actually we also relax with this. Yeah? So we're not having that battle against it. Thanks, R. The I is actually where things get interesting, I feel, in terms of Dharma. Is this investigation, the investigation of experience. Dharma vichara is one of the awakening factors that the Buddha suggested that we develop, along with mindfulness. So it's in there already, yeah? It's mindfulness. Dharma vichara, what is happening? Quality we, in English, we use this word discernment, which is to kind of see clearly into, to inquire into and kind of move our way through our experience, asking skillful questions. Asking skillful questions of our experience, like, how does this feel in the body? It's a really skillful question to ask. How am I reacting or responding to this object in my consciousness? I think another really skillful question is, what else could I do? Or how else could I see this? So it's actually quite a good example to give. We might find, you know, in the simplicity of retreat at times, that we're going to experience boredom. And boredom is such an interesting experience. Yeah. When we're bored, I think we should be really interested in that experience of boredom. But unfortunately, boredom often turns up with like a bit of aversion as well, and it's kind of hard to be with. So it's a really good one to practice with. So we just recognize, oh, I'm bored right now. Okay. Can we allow for that boredom? And then the next thing is like, where is the boredom actually? Right? We don't often get to kind of have this relationship with our boredom. It's like, where is it? Can you find it? Can you kind of like dig around in the body? It must be around here somewhere because I can feel that I'm bored. Yeah, I know that I'm bored. I'm not in doubt about it. So it must be here somewhere. Just dig around, try and find it, start to investigate. What you'll notice is as you start to do this with your boredom, it might like chase around for a while. It's kind of game of hide and seek with boredom in your mind, in your psyche, in your body. And it's like, it's usually in the hips, right? Honestly. You know, last place you look, that's where it'll be. Why is it unpleasant? Why is it unpleasant? Why is boredom unpleasant? Yeah. And then here's an interesting one. How is boredom different than calm? Like, it's like there's nothing going on, yeah? And we're all agitated about it. So what's the difference between boredom and calm? Apart from that layer of aversion. Okay? So if there's a layer of aversion, what about wanting more boredom? What about, like, I've only probably got like a 6 of boredom. I want a 10. In fact, I want 11 of boredom. And we're just going to like really try and crank up that boredom, really increase that boredom until, you know, I'm going to die of boredom. It's just going to be a flood of boredom all over me. And even the neighbors are going to get bored. There's just going to be like, it's going to be pouring out of the doors, going under the windows, you know, everything. You know, the whole neighborhood is going to be bored. We're just cranking it up. The boredom disappears. The boredom can't stand it because it's reliant on aversion. And apart from that, it's just this kind of calm. It's just a moment of calm. It's a really interesting exploration. The possibility of possibilities. Yeah, ways of practicing. So rain has an N on the end, you may have noticed. And that N could be two things. And we'll wrap up with this point. It could be two things. N could be two things. One is it could be nourishing. Yeah? Just whatever we can do to nourish ourselves. Yeah? Whatever we can do to be our best friend, our nicest support. Yeah? We might call this samadhi. Yeah? Lingering in happiness. Understanding that generosity leads to more happiness than greed. Yeah? Making peace with things leads to more happiness than the pushing away. And if we get somewhere where we manage to shift down, you know, from the high fever to the slightly lower fever, can we really enjoy that? Just really enjoy lessening the fever. And what we'll notice is that's a really good way of also lessening the fever. Yeah. So we might call this skillful attachment to the beautiful. Yeah. Desiring well-being. And more is possible. Yeah. There's always more is possible. Maybe it can soften more. Nourish us more. Come in deeper. The psychotherapist and also Dharma teacher Rick Hansen has this quality. He says, let in the good. Let in the good. If there's something good, it's normally going to slip through attention because of this negativity bias, you know, the survival mechanism. Really just linger with the good. We can afford in this day and age to just stay and look at petals. Yeah, don't need to be worried about tigers. There isn't a bear going to come and eat you. You can just linger and look at the stars. Be that kind of a person. Just give yourself the space, the nourishment. The other quality that is given the N is non-identification. Yeah, so a lot of all this problematic stuff actually came from identifying with the greed, identifying with the aversion that was coming through. It's just a natural pattern unfolding. It's just the biology, the culture, the society coming through, expressed through us. But the Dharma goes against the stream of those impulses. It goes upstream. It goes in the other direction. And so we don't want to identify with those processes and imagine that we are limited by them. The feeling of the sense of self that builds up around those experiences is a real key aspect of what brings the sense of distress, the sense of difficulty. And in the hindrances, we'll feel this tightness of a self-centered awareness at the center of this whole activity. And when we can bring in something that has more this metta flavor, this acceptance, this equanimity that's holding this all, there also comes a softer sense of the self. Yeah. Metta dissolves self. When we're angry or annoyed or even hurt, there's a strong sense of self, and that adds to the distress. When we're happy, when we're in love, when we feel supported, when we're at ease, the sense of self softens. Yeah? So metta dissolves ourselves. And it turns out that some of the nicest experiences we've ever had, we've almost barely been there. You know, our sense of self is so light, so held, so softened. And maybe less self-sense is actually a sign of freedom. Maybe less self-attachment and rigidity of self-view is the preferable direction for us. Not the getting and the getting rid of paradigm, but relating with kindness and care. So just to review, there's always a Vedana when there's contact. It's always this five-star review, but we often don't see it. Seeing it eases the escalation, eases those multiple arrows, the building up of dukkha. And being with this equanimity, this broad, spacious kind, is also a quality in our metta practice. It's holding experience with kindness, speaks of this equanimity, it's allowing, it's supporting. There's always an atmosphere, there's always a way of looking. And what happens when we investigate our experience? Feel it in the body. Support playful, skillful cultivation of experience this way. Yeah. And so tomorrow we'll dive into this in a very kind of practical way. We'll bring this into practice. And maybe for now we'll just close with silence, and if you have some questions, we'll take them in the morning. Yeah.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.